you imagine the way the world would look after the time of the second coming of Christ? Probably not, because most people are not very familiar with the Bible prophecies that talk about what will happen before the time of the second coming of Christ. But let me tell you just briefly how you can come to understand. If you could try to picture the world the way it will be within the not-too-distant future, try to think of a time beyond today, a time beyond the great tribulation described in the Bible in Matthew 24, beyond the heavenly signs and beyond the day of the Lord and the second coming of Jesus Christ. You would have to imagine the consequences of all of the major prophecies of the chaotic future. Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21, all are fulfilled. Daniel 4, 7 and 12, Revelation 6, 7, 11 and 12, Revelation 13 through 19. And you know what some of those scriptures say? Some of the most unbelievable chaotic language of apocalyptic proportions of global consequences of sin, involving wars and rumors of wars, drought, famine, disease, pestilence, nuclear bomb war, the haggard, straggling refugees of nation after nation, where perhaps, according to at least one Bible prophecy, only a tithe of humanity will remain alive. Only 10% of the populations of some major nations, if those scriptures are to be taken literally. Some say they're not to be taken literally. Some don't believe them at all. But if you were to imagine in this kind of a science fiction doomsday picture of what the world might look like. You know, we go to movies, people do. I don't very often, but I do once in a great while. I have yet to see Star Wars, but I've seen some of the introductory material to it on television, and people go and they just really enjoy these ideas of gigantic battles out in space, of whole planets blowing up, of millions dying, of laser rays and strange ray guns and so on. Well, really, we're just about to that time in world conditions right now. And we are between rounds of World War II and World War III. When World War III gets going, it's going to be a nuclear bomb war eventually, even though some of the preliminary battles may be with conventional-type weapons. And really, those preliminary battles have been raging for years already, and we're locked in the grips of a gigantic economic conflict with some of the major powers of the world, especially the supergiant of Japan, and of a growing emerging Central Europe, a coming United States of Europe. Now, if we can see in our mind's eye the world the way it will be, now is the time of Ezekiel 36, where it talks about the rebuilding of the waste places, a beginning of a rehabilitatory time where massive areas of the world are nothing but piles of shards of shattered bodies, military equipment and materiel, broken buildings, destroyed cities. It is now the time of Isaiah 60. Long ago, the major nations descended into grinding poverty. Dictatorships emerged in many nations, and conventional-type wars began. The Middle East became involved, and Europe invaded. The United States and a British Commonwealth were conquered in a nuclear bomb war. A secret pact was negotiated with Russia and Europe, and the Soviets stood by while millions died. Most major cities, according to those Bible prophecies, would be destroyed. And tens of millions would perish through drought, famine, disease, nuclear bomb blast, radiation and privation in refugee camps. Massive deportation of days survivors of many nations occurred, and millions of people were transferred to strange countries and put to work at forced labor. After Egypt and Israel fell, the Soviets were preparing for a massive nuclear attack against Europe and the Middle East when European intelligence learned of it and swiftly launched a gigantic missile counterattack against the Soviet Union. Major population centers were again destroyed as nuclear war found the great cities of Central Europe and the Soviet Union. Finally, a massive ragged army of millions swarmed toward the Middle East and was met in the beautiful valley at Megiddo, where millions more died. The waters, according to the Bible, turned to blood. The springs and fountains dried up. The very seas killed the creatures that were within it. Most of them died. The bulk of green things died. Most of the trees of the world were burnt up. The whole populations were destroyed. So now the planet, as you come on that scene, trying to envision what the future will be like, looks like a wrecked scene, like some shattered hulk from a science fiction movie. But Jesus Christ of Nazareth has split the heavens and descended to the Mount of Olives. Massive earthquakes and hailstones of nearly 100 pounds weight accompanied his coming, and millions cried out for the rocks to hide them from his brightness. The armies of the world tried to use rockets, missiles, laser rays, and hydrogen bombs to kill Christ and destroy the angels that followed him. But he destroyed them all. And that was only a few months ago. As we look into the future and try to imagine what it will be like at the beginning of a time that is called the millennium. Because, you know, most people think that the millennium is a time of peace. A time where the instant Jesus Christ arrives to the earth, peace breaks out everywhere. But the Bible says the exact opposite is true. The Bible talks of a yet 3 1/2 year ministry of Jesus Christ. A time in which the first great edict he is going to issue is quite interesting because it has to do with the observance of an annual festival that pictures that millennium. And the 14th chapter of the book of Zechariah in the Bible is one of the most interesting you could read that talks about that first great international decree that is going to go out from the world headquarters of that time, Jerusalem, in the land of Palestine. Now, as our vivid vision might see, for the past few months, emissaries from Jerusalem have come, bearing little seedlings taken from trees along the banks of a beautiful sky-blue river that has come gushing from deep beneath the earth, parting right under the translucent sea of glass beneath the very throne of Christ, right across the top of the now rent mountain that used to be the Mount of Olives. Dazed populaces have begun to dig out from under the rubble. Some semblance of order is once again established in many nations. Several women cling to just one man, saying, "We'll follow you. You be our livelihood." And wherever a member of the tribe of Judah is found, people grab him by the skirt and beg him to be their leader and say, "We'll go with you because we've heard that God is with you." The bloody waters are disappearing, and the mountainous piles of refuse, rubble, burnt-out tanks, trucks, and war machinery are being picked over for scrap. A big industry is beginning where people are beginning to melt down all the tanks and trucks and turn them into adzes and hoes and rakes and scrapers and draw knives and shovels and even try to burn some of the equipment up and salvage some of the motors and make some crude tractors to plow the fields. The beginning crops are planted that summer to be replacing those that were destroyed or burnt up by the drought. And a major new industry in Israel is the distribution of wood from crude weapons brought by millions to Armageddon as fuel for families to burn. So now it becomes autumn time, and the emissaries from the king in Jerusalem issue a decree. Powerful angels appear to leaders all over the world, and they say, "Come up to Jerusalem," they order. "Come to observe the Feast of Tabernacles." And millions willingly obey. So in a couple of months or so prior to the feast, here come delegations of leaders and heads of families and representatives of tribes from the Dutch and the Vietnamese, the Belgians and the Poles, the Danes and Indonesians, refugees from Australia, and Americans who were scattered in Europe, South America, and Africa. And here come the Peruvians, the Norwegians, the Russians and Japanese, Bantus, Zulus, Hausas, and Igbos, Panamanians and Persians, Laplanders and Lebanese, Serbs and Spanish, hundreds of thousands of people representing most of the people on the earth, representatives of every remaining tribe and nation are helping one another, using every kind of surviving vehicle, enlisting the aid of angels when need be, and of each other, and a massive exodus is underway as the leaders and delegates of all those nations go toward Jerusalem to sit at the feet of the new world leader, Jesus Christ of Nazareth, and to hear how he's going to sort out all this mess, how he's going to organize the world, what his new government is going to be like. To learn what the next 1,000 years will bring forth on this earth. To hear whether or not we have a real chance at that time for humanity to survive. To hear whether or not we can avoid the cataclysmic, apocalyptic wars that rent the earth and nearly destroyed all of civilization. But strangely, the Egyptians refuse. Shockingly, even though their waters had cleared and irrigation had begun again, and the first tender shoots of the summer crop had sprung up out of the ground, the waters began to darken again, springs dried up, traditional oases and water holes were dust, the crops died, and a terrible drought set in. The temperature soared to more than 120 degrees every single day for a month. And now, in our mind's eye, we see into the future that it is now the time for the Day of Atonement, a day of fasting. The Egyptians have had to fast for the last several days because there isn't any more food. Powerful warnings have come in the form of human leaders as well as angels. And so they finally relent and decide to humbly go to Jerusalem and to observe the Feast of Tabernacles. Now, you may think I'm making this all up. No, I'm really not. Everything I have told you is an excerpt from one or another of these major prophecies of the Bible, and especially this scene in Zechariah, the 14th chapter.